Imagine for a second trying to build this incredibly delicate, perfectly functioning mechanical pocket watch, but you are trying to build it inside the caldera of an active erupting volcano.
Right. Yeah, that's a fantastic visual.
And to make it even crazier, imagine that on top of those incredibly hostile conditions, you only have a split second to assemble all the microscopic gears and springs before the entire thing is just completely incinerated.
Which is, I mean, obviously impossible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But for decades, the narrative that you and I have been fed about the origin of life has been the exact opposite of that picture. We've been told that it was this, well, this slow, inevitable crawl.
Yeah, the classic warm little pond idea.
Oh, right. The idea is that if you have a massive, quiet ocean and just billions upon billions of years, the impossible eventually becomes, you know, a mathematical certainty. Just mix some chemicals, wait for an absolute eternity, and life will eventually bubble up.
It is a very comforting idea, really. I mean, it completely removes the mystery and replaces it with sheer probability. Back in 1954, George Wald, who was a Nobel laureate, by the way, he wrote a really famous piece for Scientific American outlining this exact paradigm.
I think I know the quote you're talking about.
Yeah, he was talking about how life began on early Earth, and he wrote a line that essentially became the scientific dogma for the next 70 years. He literally said, "Time is the hero of the plot."
Time is the hero.
Exactly. The argument was that given enough time, the improbable becomes probable, and the probable becomes virtually certain.
But our mission today in this deep dive is to see if that story actually survives contact with modern data. Because today, we are pulling from this massive, incredibly rigorous source text called The Origin Enigma. We're going to be specifically focusing on Chapter 5.
And it is an incredibly dense chapter, but so rewarding to unpack.
Oh, absolutely. And what this text does is put that whole magic of deep time narrative under an uncompromising microscope using strict modern geological and, well, thermodynamic data.
And I'll tell you right now, the conclusion it reaches is going to completely dismantle that 1954 paradigm. What the modern data shows us is that the timeline for life to emerge wasn't a slow, simmering, multi-billion year marathon at all.
Not even close, right?
No, not at all. The window of opportunity was, geologically speaking, a microscopic flash. Yeah. And even more surprisingly, and we'll get into this, when we look at the specific chemical mechanisms that modern researchers propose to speed up life's assembly within that tiny window, we find that those exact mechanisms actively destroy the building blocks of life.
Wow.
Yeah, when you put them in a realistic early Earth environment, they tear biology apart.
So, if we're going to figure out why time isn't the hero of this story, I feel like we have to start by looking at the clock. We need to figure out exactly how much time the Earth actually gave us to work with.
That is exactly where we need to start.
So our source dives into the geological reality of the very first chapter of Earth's history. Geologists call this the Hadean Aeon. And, I mean, just the name alone, Hadean, named after Hades, the ancient Greek underworld, that paints a pretty grim picture right out of the gate.
It's extremely fitting.
What are we actually looking at when the Earth first forms, roughly 4.54 billion years ago?
Well, we are looking at an environment that is entirely, unequivocally off the table for prebiotic chemistry. The popular imagination sometimes pictures the Earth forming, you know, the oceans settling down nicely, and the clock for life immediately starting to tick.
Like a nice primordial soup.
Exactly. But planetary science tells us a very, very different story. The first 500 million years of Earth's existence are characterized by something called the late heavy bombardment.
Okay, I want to make sure we're visualizing this correctly for everyone listening, because bombardment almost sounds like, you know, a bad meteor shower you'd watch from your backyard. But the text is talking about impactors that are just incomprehensibly massive.
Oh, completely. We are talking about asteroids and planetesimals up to 500 kilometers in diameter, repeatedly striking the young planet.
500 kilometers. Wait, that's essentially taking a solid block of iron and rock the size of the entire state of Pennsylvania.
Or the distance from New York to Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Right. And just slamming it into the Earth at tens of thousands of miles per hour. What is an impact of that absolute scale actually do to a planet?
The kinetic energy released is staggering. When an object that massive hits the Earth, it doesn't just make a really big crater. The energy is converted into heat on a global scale. Impacts of this magnitude had enough energy to literally boil the early oceans entirely into steam.
The entire ocean?
Yeah.
Just gone.
The whole thing. The atmosphere would become this dense, superheated vapor of rock and water. The upper crust of the Earth didn't just crack from the impact. The surface literally melted into a global magma ocean.
That is terrifying.
You would have massive global temperature spikes pushing the environment well over 150 degrees Celsius for thousands of years at a time.
And that specific temperature threshold, 150 degrees Celsius, the source points out that this is basically the kill switch, right?
It is the absolute limit for the survival of complex organic chemistry. Amino acids, the precursors to nucleic acids, delicate carbon bonds, none of them can survive those conditions.
So they just burn up.
At 150 degrees Celsius, complex organic molecules are rapidly, violently torn apart. They are incinerated. So even if some quiet, shallow pool managed to somehow form some interesting molecular precursors during a lull in the asteroid strikes,
the next massive impact would just come along and completely reset the planetary hard drive.
Precisely. It wipes the slate completely clean.
So it's this incredibly violent period of cyclic sterilization.
Yeah.
You can have all the carbon and water you want on the planet, but the environment is actively hostile to anything complex forming.
Okay.
It's the volcano from the pocket watch analogy we started with. You simply cannot accumulate chemical complexity when the entire planet is being repeatedly flash fried.
You really can't. And this era of cyclic, total planetary sterilization doesn't truly end until about 3.9 to 4.0 billion years ago.
Okay, so mark that on the timeline. 4 billion years ago.
Right. That is the point where the latest geological models, like the ones from planetary scientist Kevin Zonnell and his colleagues, indicate that the bombardment finally subsides. The impactors get smaller and a lot less frequent, which allows the crust to actually cool down.
Meaning the oceans can finally come back.
Exactly. Critically, it allows that massive steam atmosphere to condense, so stable liquid oceans can finally persist without being boiled away into the sky every few million years.
So roughly 4.0 billion years ago is the absolute earliest that the environment is stable enough for the prebiotic chemistry clock to even begin ticking.
Yes, that is the starting gun.
But what happens next completely blows up the deep time narrative. Because the moment that window opens, the moment the oceans actually settle, we do not see a slow billion-year buildup of chemicals randomly bumping into each other. Life just suddenly shows up.
It appears almost instantaneously on a geological timescale. And we aren't just guessing here, by the way. The evidence is physically recorded in the rocks. Our source walked through the specific geochemistry of this, starting with the Jack Hills in Western Australia.
Oh, right. The zircon crystals.
Yes. Geologists have found these microscopic, incredibly resilient minerals called zircon crystals. Zircons are fantastic because they essentially trap little time capsules of the environment when they form. And inside these specific zircons, which are reliably dated to 4.1 billion years ago, scientists have found graphite inclusions.
Okay, wait, let's break that down. Graphite is just carbon, right? Like, what's in a pencil lead?
Exactly.
How does finding a tiny speck of graphite tell us anything about whether life was there?
It comes down to isotopes. Carbon naturally comes in different weights in the environment, primarily carbon-12, which is lighter, and carbon-13, which is slightly heavier. Now, here is the crucial mechanism we need to understand. Life is fundamentally lazy.
Lazy? How so?
Well, when a biological system, like a microbe, pulls carbon out of the environment to build its cells or process energy, its enzymes strongly prefer to use the lighter carbon-12.
Because it's literally lighter.
Yes.
Yeah.
It requires slightly less energetic effort to process.
That makes perfect sense. It's easier to lift a 10-pound weight than an 11-pound weight, so if you're a microscopic machine trying to save energy, you grab the lighter one every time.
Exactly. And because biological systems selectively hoard that carbon-12, the organic material they leave behind when they die has a very specific skewed ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13 compared to just the normal dead background environment. We call this a biogenic carbon isotope signature.
So it's literally a chemical fingerprint of biology doing work.
Yes. And that exact skewed signature, which is overwhelmingly associated with biological enzymatic activity, is locked inside those 4.1 billion-year-old zircon crystals.
Wait a minute. 4.1 billion years ago? You just said the late heavy bombardment didn't even taper off until 4.0 or 3.9 billion years ago. That means we have a chemical fingerprint of life overlapping with the very end of the sterilization period.
It does. It strongly suggests that life was present almost the very millisecond the Earth could physically sustain it.
That is wild.
But, you know, even if we want to take the most conservative possible approach to the geological data and say, all right, let's set the zircons aside for a moment, the picture doesn't get any better for the deep time narrative.
Right, because there's more evidence right after that.
Right. If we look at the Isua Greenstone Belt in Greenland, which dates between 3.8 and 3.7 billion years ago, we find carbon signatures in sedimentary rocks that show unambiguous evidence of complex microbial metabolism.
And it goes way beyond just chemical fingerprints, too. The source material points to the Pilbara Craton in Western Australia, dated at 3.5 billion years ago. And there, we aren't just looking at molecular ratios, we're looking at actual physical fossils.
Yes, undisputed fossilized stromatolites.
And for anyone listening who isn't familiar, stromatolites aren't just like individual floating bacteria.
Right? No, not at all. They are macroscopic, layered, rocky structures built by complex, diverse communities of microbes working together. Many of these communities were likely photosynthetic, meaning they were already taking in sunlight and building massive, structured bacterial cities on the shallow seafloor.
And they are definitively there by 3.5 billion years ago.
Undeniably.
Let's actually do the math on this timeline, because the implications are massive for this deep dive. If the Earth's crust finally cools and stops boiling at roughly 4.0 billion years ago, and we have complex, fossilized microbial communities definitively existing by 3.8 or maybe 3.7 billion years ago,
the available window for abiogenesis shrinks dramatically.
Right. The transition from dead, floating chemicals to a fully functioning living cell, that entire process shrinks to under 200 million years.
That is the strict mathematical verdict from the geology. The window is less than 200 million years.
Okay, I think we need to pause here because I can practically hear the skeptic listening to this. If I'm listening, I'm thinking, all right, 200 million years is obviously a lot shorter than a billion, but to a human being, 200 million years still sounds like an incredibly long time.
It does sound like an eternity to us.
Yeah, but our source material claims that from a chemical standpoint, 200 million years is statistically zero. Why is that not enough time for chemicals to just randomly bump into each other and figure it out?
Because of the sheer mathematical scale of what needs to be built, we are running into a wall that information theorists call combinatorial inflation.
Combinatorial inflation. Let's unpack that.
Let's look at the mechanism. To build even the most minimal theoretical first cell, you don't just need organic chemicals to gather in a puddle. You need them to link together into very long, highly specific sequences to form functional proteins, or RNA.
Right. It's not just a clump of chemicals. It's a highly specific instruction manual.
Exactly. Let's take just one modestly sized functional protein, say a chain of 150 amino acids. There are 20 different types of amino acids used in life. So for the first slot in the chain, you have 20 options.
Okay.
For the second slot, you also have 20 options. To find the total number of possible combinations for a chain of 150, you have to calculate 20 to the power of 150.
Which is 20 times 20 times 20, 150 times.
Yes. And that number is so astronomically vast that it exceeds the number of atoms in the entire observable universe by many, many orders of magnitude.
And most of those combinations are just useless junk, right? They don't fold into a working biological machine.
The vast, overwhelming majority are completely useless. So if you are relying on unguided chemistry to blindly search through that sequence space by randomly bumping amino acids together, just trying to hit upon a functional fold, you run out of time almost immediately.
It's like having a combination lock on a bicycle, but instead of four dials, it has 150 dials, and each dial has 20 numbers on it. You can't just forcefully jiggle the lock and hope it pops open. You'd have to try trillions of combinations a second, and even then, 200 million years barely gets you through a microscopic fraction of a percent of the possibilities.
That is a very accurate analogy. And our source cites a brilliant 2025 Bayesian analysis by an astronomer named David Kipping that actually runs the numbers on this.
What did he find?
He looked at this rapid, almost instantaneous appearance of life on Earth and ran the statistics. He essentially proved that this compressed timeline totally forecloses the idea of a slow, gradual chemical accumulation.
Because it's too fast.
Right. If the origin of life was a difficult chemical accident that required a massive amount of random trial and error, it statistically should have taken billions of years after the oceans cooled. The fact that it happened almost immediately tells us that the random accumulation model is deeply, deeply flawed.
So it's either an impossible stroke of luck happening on the very first try, or the fundamental mechanism we've been relying on is just wrong.
Exactly. And this is further corroborated by Robert Andres, a biophysicist who published some algorithmic modeling in 2025. He mapped out the thermodynamic and informational requirements to assemble the structured information of just a minimal protocell.
And he used that 200 million year window.
Yes. He fed a 200 million year timeline into his models. He gave the models the entire ocean volume of the Hadean Earth and allowed the chemical reactions to happen millions of times a second.
So he was giving every possible benefit of the doubt to the unguided chemistry.
Oh, absolutely. Best case scenario for the chemicals. And his algorithmic models prove that the timeline is astronomically insufficient.
Even with all those advantages.
Even then, the probabilistic resources of the entire planet reacting for 200 million years barely scratches the surface of the sequence space required for just one specific functional protein, let alone the integrated, synchronized suite of hundreds of different proteins needed to make a system alive. In the realm of probability, trying to achieve this specific task in 200 million years is mathematically indistinguishable from having zero time at all.
Okay, this creates a massive crisis for the standard narrative. The vast oceans of deep time are an illusion. George Wald's hero time is dead. It didn't exist.
It really didn't.
So if Origin of Life scientists realize they don't have billions of years, how are they trying to cheat that ticking clock? Because they have to know about this geological data. There must be some proposed mechanism out there trying to act as a fast-forward button to force these chemicals together within that tiny window.
There is. And it has generated an immense amount of press and excitement recently. It brings us to the highly publicized wet-dry cycle hypothesis. But to really understand why researchers so desperately need this cycle, we first have to explain the fundamental thermodynamic problem of water itself. The source refers to this as the water paradox.
This is fascinating to me because when NASA looks for signs of life on exoplanets or on Mars, the very first thing they look for is liquid water.
Always, yes.
We are taught that water is the absolute prerequisite for biology. Why is water suddenly a paradox when we're trying to build the first cell?
Because there is a vast difference between maintaining an already living system and building a biological system from scratch. Water is an excellent solvent, which is great for moving nutrients around inside a living cell. But in the context of prebiotic chemistry, when you're trying to link small building blocks into long chains, water is an aggressive, destructive force.
Marty. Destructive.
Yes. It's governed by a process called hydrolysis.
Let's break down that mechanism. If I drop a bunch of individual amino acids into a primordial ocean, why won't they just naturally link arms and form a long protein chain?
Because of the thermodynamic reality of chemical equilibrium. When two amino acids link together to form a peptide bond, that specific chemical reaction releases a molecule of water as a byproduct.
Okay, I follow.
Now, we have to look at Le Chatelier's principle, which dictates how chemical systems maintain balance.
Can we translate Le Chatelier's principle into an everyday visual?
Let's imagine a crowded subway car.
Oh, perfect.
If a bunch of people are trying to push their way in through the doors, the pressure forces people who are already inside to push back or eventually get pushed out the other side just to relieve the congestion.
Right. The system wants to balance the pressure.
Chemical reactions behave similarly. If a reaction produces a byproduct, and you are doing that reaction in an environment already overflowing with that exact byproduct, the environment pushes back. It drives the reaction in reverse.
So because linking amino acids releases water, doing it inside an ocean, which is literally made of water, means the ocean is going to shove that water molecule right back into the bond and break it apart.
Precisely. The equilibrium in an aqueous environment overwhelmingly favors broken monomers over assembled polymers. Water forces its way into the bonds. In a primordial ocean, water acts as a relentless chemical shredder. It actively dismantles the very polymers required for life faster than they can ever naturally form.
Wow. So if water destroys polymers, the proposed solution from the scientific community is actually kind of brilliant in its simplicity. Just remove the water.
Exactly.
If water is the shredder, get the chemicals out of the ocean.
Okay.
This is the wet-dry cycle, or I think the paper calls it the hydro-Eolian pulse model.
It is logically straightforward. Instead of a deep open ocean, picture a shallow primordial puddle on the rocky side of a volcanic island. A wave splashes up, depositing some organic building blocks, amino acids or nucleotides, into this little depression in the rock.
Then the sun comes out.
And the puddle evaporates. Exactly. The water disappears. And as the water evaporates, the molecules that were dissolved in it are forced closer and closer together on the rock surface. This concentrates them. And theoretically, without the massive bulk of water there to push back and tear the bonds apart via hydrolysis, the thermal energy from the sun forces the molecules to link up into chains.
Then what happens? The puddle is just dry dust.
No, then the cycle continues. The tide comes back in, or a rainstorm hits and rehydrates the puddle. This redissolves those newly formed chains so they can float around, interact with new molecules, mix up, and then the puddle dries out again. Wet, dry, wet, dry, over and over.
It sounds incredibly elegant. And apparently scientists have been running these exact cycles in modern laboratories, right? Our source gives them a very fair hearing. What kind of results are they actually getting when they try this today?
The laboratory results have been highly touted as massive breakthroughs. For instance, the source details a major 2024 paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by a team led by a researcher named Song.
And what do they do?
In their experiment, they took adenosine monophosphate, or AMP, and uridine monophosphate, UMP. These are the molecular precursors to RNA.
The letters in the genetic code.
Exactly. They put these nucleotides in water, heated the mixture to 80 degrees Celsius, dried it out completely to simulate that evaporation phase we talked about, and then added water to rehydrate it. By running this wet-dry cycling over and over, they successfully forced these molecules to bond, producing RNA-like chains that were 30 to 50 nucleotides long.
30 to 50 nucleotides. That sounds like an absolute home run. I mean, if you read that in a headline, you'd think it completely solved the assembly problem.
And that isn't the only one. The text also highlights a 2025 study from Frankel Pinter's team published in Nature Chemistry. They showed that when you put complex chemical mixtures through these wet-dry cycles, the molecules don't just form random chaotic blobs.
What do they form?
They demonstrated a phenomenon they called population synchronicity. The cycles actually showed a tendency to drive a degree of chemical self-organization.
So I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of someone reading these press releases. If scientists can literally make organized RNA chains in a lab just by drying out a puddle and getting it wet again, doesn't that solve everything? Doesn't that act as the perfect fast-forward button to beat that 200-million-year clock we were talking about earlier?
You would think so.
So why is our source material saying this entire idea is an illusion? What are these researchers not telling the public?
What the headlines don't mention is the vast, unbridgeable chasm between the highly controlled, pristine conditions inside that laboratory and the actual chaotic physical reality of the early Earth. To answer why it fails, we have to pull the camera back from the gleaming laboratory bench with its commercially purified reagents and glass beakers and drop these exact same chemicals into a genuine, realistic Hadean puddle.
And the moment we do that, the chemistry completely changes.
Completely. And this drops us right into the dirty water critique, which completely obliterates the wet-dry cycle. The fundamental problem is that the early Earth did not have a chemical supply catalog.
Right. You couldn't just order pure AMP off the internet.
Exactly. The source leans heavily on a devastating 2025 thermodynamic analysis by synthetic chemist James Tour, along with researchers Parker and Janes. They expose what they call the clean room fallacy. Let's look back at the Song experiment that produced those impressive RNA chains. The investigators didn't just scoop up dirt from outside. They used artificially purified, isolated AMP and UMP.
So they cheated, essentially.
Well, they bought reagents that were 99% pure, mixed them in perfectly clean distilled water, and ran the cycles.
They isolated the exact molecules they wanted to react and aggressively excluded anything that might interfere. But a realistic prebiotic pool on a volcanic island isn't distilled water. It is what James Tour calls dirty water.
It is a chaotic, heterogeneous chemical soup. If a natural puddle somehow managed to accumulate some amino acids or nucleotides, those molecules are not sitting there in pristine isolation. That same puddle is heavily contaminated with a massive zoo of other naturally occurring chemicals. You have highly reactive sugars, aldehydes, ketones, and dissolved metal ions all crammed into the exact same microscopic space.
Let's translate some of those terms for a minute, because this is where the chemistry gets really treacherous. What happens when you mix all those reactive contaminants together and then apply the heat of a wet-dry cycle? Why don't the amino acids just ignore the other stuff and link up into proteins?
Because chemistry is fundamentally a blind competition based on kinetics, which simply means the speed of the reaction. Molecules don't have goals. They don't know they're supposed to build life. They react with whatever is closest and fastest.
Okay, that makes sense.
And when you apply heat to evaporate this dirty water, say, the puddle reaches 80 degrees Celsius under the Haitian sun, you do not get a neat, clean linking of amino acids into biological proteins. Instead, the heat triggers a completely different process called the Maillard
The
reaction.
Maillard reaction. We actually know this from the kitchen, don't we? This is the same chemical reaction that makes the crust of bread turn brown in the oven, or what gives a seared steak its flavor. It's a reaction between amino acids and sugars under high heat.
That is precisely what it is. To build life, you need amino acids to build proteins, and you need sugars to build the backbone of RNA and DNA. So a prebiotic puddle would logically contain both. But when you heat a mixture containing both amino acids and sugars, the amino group of the amino acid aggressively attacks the carbonyl group of the sugar.
Meaning they smash into each other instead of linking up with their own kind.
Yes. They form something called a shift base, and you don't need to memorize the jargon to understand the mechanism. The important part is that this shift base rapidly undergoes a series of complex structural rearrangements. It cross-links the molecules together in every conceivable direction, forming highly complex, insoluble brown polymers known as melanoidins. In the origin of life chemistry field, this specific dead end is so pervasive they gave it a very memorable name, the asphalt problem.
The asphalt problem. Let's go back to the kitchen analogy to really drive this home. If you were a scientist in a clean room, the laboratory, and you put perfectly measured, pure flour, pure yeast, and pure water into a precise automated bread maker, you get a beautiful structured loaf of bread. That's the lab experiment.
Yes, highly controlled.
But a realistic Haitian puddle is like taking raw eggs, a bag of sugar, a handful of metal screws, some lemon juice, and actual dirt, throwing all of it into an oven and cranking it to 500 degrees.
I love that.
The heat does not magically organize the mess into a cake. The heat cross-links everything together into a charred, irreversible, sticky black tar.
That analogy is chemically exact. The heat of the evaporation phase fundamentally forces the molecules into the wrong structural configurations. And the critical fatal factor here is the kinetics we mentioned earlier. The speed of the Maillard reaction is astronomically faster than the constructive formation of a biological peptide bond.
Really? How much faster? Are they competing neck and neck?
Not at all. The Maillard reaction into tar is kinetically favored millions of times over the formation of biological polymers. It proceeds exponentially faster. So when you have a natural, unguided wet-dry cycle in the wild, the application of heat to drive off the water explicitly and overwhelmingly accelerates the production of useless melanoid in asphalt. It does not accelerate biological complexity.
So the very mechanism that researchers proposed to save their models from the water paradox, the drying out phase, actually drives the chemistry directly into a brick wall. If you have the building blocks in the same pool, they don't cooperate to build a cell. They chemically annihilate each other to form tar.
Exactly. But let's extend every possible benefit of the doubt just to be thorough. Let's imagine that by some sheer, mathematically absurd stroke of luck, a delicate RNA polymer manages to miraculously form during the dry phase without turning into tar. We still have to account for the other half of the cycle.
Right, because eventually the sun goes down, the tide comes back in, or a storm rolls over the island. The wet-dry cycle requires a wet phase. Rehydration. What happens to that miraculous RNA chain the moment it rains?
This is what the source identifies as the thermodynamic death spiral. The moment the water returns, the thermodynamic reality of hydrolysis comes roaring right back with it. Remember, the ocean is still governed by chemical equilibrium. The water immediately begins attacking the bonds of that newly formed polymer.
Because the chemical environment still wants to rip it apart. It wants
Yeah.
to relieve the pressure in the crowded subway car.
Precisely. And the degradation half-life of these prebiotic sequences in water isn't measured in millions of years. It is measured in days or even hours. So the cycle is entirely futile. During the dry phase, you might force a few chemical bonds together, assuming you're constantly fighting the overwhelming probability of the asphalt problem. But during the wet phase, the destruction is comprehensive. The thermal reset is absolute. Synthesis and degradation cycle together in a strict one-to-one ratio.
It's like a chemical hamster wheel. You are spinning and spinning furiously, expending all this energy, but you never actually travel anywhere. You build a tiny segment of a chain, and the water destroys it completely. You build another segment, the water wipes it out. There is absolutely zero net accumulation of genetic information.
None.
You cannot use a mechanism to slowly accumulate biological complexity if that mechanism actively wipes its own hard drive every single time it rains.
That is the ultimate failing of the model. The wet-dry cycle provides no ratchet mechanism. A ratchet is a tool that lets you pull a rope forward and locks it in place so it can't slip backward.
Yeah.
But in unguided chemistry, there is no ratchet to lock in partial progress. The rate of destruction always outpaces the rate of synthesis.
Okay, this is where things get genuinely confusing for me, and I know it's confusing for anyone reading popular science articles on this. Because if you read the literature from the scientists conducting these wet-dry experiments, you will constantly see them use a very specific, highly loaded word to describe what's happening.
Oh, I know exactly what word you're going to say.
They will claim that the wet-dry cycle selects for certain polymers. They use the phrase chemical selection to imply that the puddle is naturally working its way toward biology.
Yes, the word selection is pervasive in the literature, and it is incredibly effective rhetorically because the moment a layperson hears the word selection, their mind immediately goes to Charles Darwin.
Exactly. We hear selection, and we think of natural selection. We think of evolution, progress, and simple things slowly adapting into complex things. We think the chemistry is doing the work of biology, but our source material is absolutely adamant that this is a massive vocabulary trick. It's a linguistic sleight of hand.
It is perhaps the most vital conceptual distinction in the entire origin of life debate. The scientific literature pervasively conflates the terms chemical selection and biological selection. But physically, mathematically, and thermodynamically, they operate by absolutely contradictory rules. The source text demands that we explicitly untangle them.
Let's do that right now, then. Let's break down the actual rules. What is biological selection?
Biological selection is what Darwin described. It is the ratchet of life. But for biological selection to work, it requires a system that is capable of differential reproduction.
Meaning you need an organism that can consume energy, make a faithful copy of itself, pass on its genetic code, and occasionally make a microscopic copying error mutation.
Correct. If that random mutation happens to confer an advantage, say it makes a bacterium slightly faster at processing sunlight, that specific organism outcompetes its neighbors. It survives, it reproduces, and crucially, its genome records the improvement.
It saves the data.
Yes. The genetic code, the DNA or RNA, acts as a physical memory bank. This memory is what allows biological selection to preserve complex, far from equilibrium states and transmit them across generations. It can ratchet upward in complexity because it has a mechanism to save its progress.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. It's an upward progression because the blueprint remembers what worked. But that entire process requires a fully functioning, replicating cell with a genetic hard drive to already exist. Prebiotic chemicals floating in a Hadean puddle don't have DNA. They don't have a memory bank. So when scientists talk about chemical selection, what is the environment actually selecting for?
Chemical selection operates entirely, 100%, by the laws of thermodynamics. In a prebiotic pool, the environment does not select for biological function. It does not select for future complexity. It does not care if a particular molecule might eventually be useful millions of years later to form a cell wall or a ribosome.
Oh.
Prebiotic chemistry selects purely for thermodynamic stability.
And what does thermodynamic stability mean in plain English?
It is the relentless drive of all physical matter to seek the lowest available energy state. Think of a spinning top.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
When a top is spinning rapidly, it is in a high-energy, organized state. But friction and gravity are constantly pulling at it, trying to drag it down. The top eventually falls over and stops moving entirely. It has reached its lowest energy state. A living cell is like a beautifully complex top that has internal motors continuously firing to keep itself spinning. It is a state far from thermodynamic equilibrium.
So if a living cell is the spinning top, what is chemical selection?
Chemical selection is the friction. It is the gravity. It is the environment pulling the matter down until it stops moving. When chemical selection operates on a mixture of organic molecules in a puddle, it drives them toward dead, inert materials. It drives them toward periodic crystals, or molecules lock into repetitive, low-energy grids that can't do biological work. Or, as we discussed with the Maillard reaction, it drives them toward inert tar and asphalt.
Wait. So, in the eyes of pure chemistry, turning into a lump of black tar isn't a failure, it's a massive success.
Thermodynamically, tar is an absolute triumph. The molecules have formed incredibly stable bonds, they have dissipated their chemical energy, and the resulting structure resists any further reaction. It has reached the bottom of the energy valley. It is perfectly stable.
If I'm following the logic here, the contradiction is staggering. Chemical selection isn't just the slower, clumsier version of biological evolution. It isn't trying to build life. It is actively trying to prevent it. It is driving the entire system in the exact opposite direction.
That is the uncompromising conclusion of the physics. A living organism is a marvel of non-equilibrium thermodynamics. It requires continuous energy expenditure, constant structural repair mechanisms, and active molecular pumps just to fight off the pull of thermodynamic equilibrium. When a living cell finally loses that battle and reaches thermodynamic equilibrium with its environment, we have a very simple word for that state.
We call it death.
Yes. Death is the ultimate thermodynamic equilibrium for biological matter. Chemical selection is the relentless physical pull toward that equilibrium.
The contradiction is absolute. You cannot use a mechanism that fundamentally drives matter toward inert, dead tar to explain the origin of a system that actively, continuously fights against becoming inert, dead par. It's completely backward.
It really is.
It's like trying to explain how a mechanical pump was built to push water up to a high tower by studying the physics of water flowing down a drain. The physics of water flowing down a drain will never design a pump. It just empties the sink. Chemical selection pulls things down to tar. It doesn't build up to DNA. And biological selection cannot come to the rescue because biological selection literally does not exist until the fully functioning replicating cell has already been completely built.
Exactly. To invoke the word selection in a prebiotic environment as if it were a creative, forward-looking force is to smuggle a biological concept into a purely chemical domain where it has absolutely no physical reality. The chemistry of the Hadean Earth was not incubating life. It wasn't nurturing it in a warm little pond. It was actively thermodynamically hostile to it.
This has been an incredibly intense deep dive, and I think we need to synthesize exactly what we've discovered by putting this specific narrative under the microscope. We started by looking at this almost universally accepted cultural assumption that time is the hero of the plot, that given billions of years, the impossible becomes inevitable.
Right.
But when we applied the lens of modern geological data, that foundation totally collapsed. The timeline for the origin of life is functionally zero. We went from a sterile, molten rock, sterilized by 500-kilometer asteroids, to complex photosynthetic microbial communities in under 200 million years.
And we demonstrated that 200 million years is mathematically insufficient to search the sequence space for even a single protein. The time simply wasn't there. And when origin of life researchers attempt to solve that timeline crisis by proposing environmental speed-up mechanisms like the wet-dry cycle, a strict thermodynamic audit proves that these cycles fail catastrophically in the real world.
Because of the dirty water.
Exactly. Far from building the hardware of life, the kinetic reality of the dirty water found in any natural environment means these wet-dry cycles explicitly accelerate the destruction of organic precursors via the Maillard reaction. The proposed solution actively creates tar.
The environment was incredibly hostile, the window of time was practically non-existent, and the fundamental laws of chemical selection were actively driving matter toward death, not life. Which leaves us in a fascinating place and leads to a final, deeply provocative thought that our source material introduces based on the Viracocha principle.
Ah, yes. The Viracocha principle, or the principle of a true cause, is a foundational concept in historical science. It states that when we are trying to explain a past event, we must attribute it to a cause that we know, based on our present observations, actually has the power to produce the effect in question.
So, if we see a sandcastle on the beach, the Viracocha principle says we shouldn't attribute it to the wind and the waves because we observe that wind and waves destroy structures, they don't build them. We attribute it to an intelligent agent, a person with a bucket, because we know intelligent agents have the causal power to build complex specified structures.
Precisely. And this is the ultimate implication of everything we've rigorously audited today. If the universe did not slowly build life over billions of years in a warm, chemically accommodating pond.
Which it didn't.
Right. If, rather, astonishing biological complexity appeared virtually overnight, the very moment the Earth's crust cooled enough to support it. And if it appeared while the fundamental laws of chemistry, kinetics, and thermodynamics were actively fighting to tear it apart into asphalt, what does that tell you about the source of the biological information required to build the first cell?
It tells you something profound, something that completely upends the old paradigm. If the physical medium, the chemistry of the early Earth, is actively hostile to the message must have originated from outside the medium. We can't look at the living world as a slow, inevitable accident of time anymore. The strict data of modern science has cleared away the murky, comfortable illusion of deep time. and what we see in the glaring light of the Hadean Eon is startling. It forces you to look at life not as a consequence of chemistry, but as a sudden, deliberate insertion of brilliant code against the dark, chaotic, and actively destructive backdrop of the early Earth. It seems the impossible didn't just become inevitable given enough time. It violently interrupted the inevitable. And that is a thought worth unpacking long after this deep dive is over.